Welcome to this throwback edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. Today's episode was originally published on October 8th, 2022. I'm playing it today because there's been a lot of news recently about the rise of the international far right at the same time as Donald Trump has been making some of his most explicitly fascist threats about what he'll do if he wins a second term. And we will be covering all of that news soon, but this episode gives context to that ongoing movement. Sources include The Mehdi Hasan Show, The Jacobin Show, The Rachel Maddow Show, In the Thick, Democracy Now!, and The Muckrake Political Podcast.
In the wake of last week's Italian elections, Giorgia Meloni, leader of the far-right neo-fascist Brothers of Italy party, is poised to become that country's next prime minister. And Republicans here in the US have been falling over themselves to congratulate her on her win and identify themselves with the neo-fascist. Here are former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Republican Senator Tom Cotton, both congratulating Meloni as a fellow conservative, apparently. And when an old speech of Meloni's decrying financial speculators, yes, financial speculators, I think we all know who she's referring to there, went viral in right-wing circles, Republican Senator Ted Cruz tweeted, "Spectacular." Even though his own wife is a managing director at what some would say is the grand champion of actual financial speculators, Goldman Sachs. My favorite right-wing tweet about Meloni, though, was this one from an employee of Breitbart who decided to dabble in a bit of identity politics, suggesting, "You're for the patriarchy if you dare criticize Italy's first female prime minister," and also tweeting hilariously, "Calling her Mussolini just because she's Italian is racist." To which I responded, "How about comparing her to Mussolini because she has praised Mussolini, currently echoes Mussolini, and runs a party that both includes Mussolini's heirs and is itself an heir to the Italian social movement, which was formed by supporters of Mussolini in 1946. How about that?" By the way, did you see how I managed to squeeze all that relevant biographical information about Meloni into 140 characters or whatever the Twitter limit is these days? Because a lot of mainstream media pieces running into the hundreds or thousands of words weren't able to do that, sadly. And I'll be honest, I expected the Republican right to embrace Meloni. They are at best, to quote the president, semi-fascist themselves these days. What's been so depressing is to see so much of the quote-unquote liberal media, the mainstream media, the MSM, giving a pass to Meloni or playing down her and her party's fascist roots, focusing more on the fact that she's female and less on the fact that she's, you know, fascistic. That has been deeply, deeply depressing to see. There was the Washington Post headline, "Giorgia Meloni could become Italy's first female prime minister. Here's what to know." Now, here's what you wouldn't know from that headline. You wouldn't know that she has ties to fascism. But hey, she's female. There was the headline in the Financial Times. We could pull that up as well. "Likely victory for Italian right portends risks, but no lurch into extremism." Don't worry, no lurch to extremism, even though they just elected card-carrying extremists. But still, hers is a heartwarming tale, isn't it? I kid you not, this was the tweet from Politico Europe. Let's pull up the tweet from Politico Europe. "In July 1992, a 15-year-old schoolgirl rang the doorbell at a local branch of the Youth Front, a far-right movement in Rome, and asked to be let in. This weekend, that same schoolgirl could become Italy's next prime minister." Wow. Forget the fascism. Forget the fascism. Focus on the inspiration there. Then there was this op-ed in the New York Times. "Giorgia Meloni is extreme, but she's no tyrant." Well, that's all right then. At least she's not a tyrant. There was this op-ed in The Atlantic, which argued that the most immediate concern about Italy's new government is not any threat to the country's democratic institutions, still less a return to fascism. Did you notice a trend yet? It's not as bad as you think. This isn't really fascism. Stop the hyperbole and hysteria. It'll all be fine. In fact, I couldn't help but think that I've seen these headlines, these hot takes before. Remember the Washington Post op-ed on the eve of the 2016 US presidential election with this headline? "Calm down. We'll be fine no matter who wins." Oh yeah. Remember the New York Times op-ed with this headline the month before the 2020 presidential election? "There will be no Trump coup." So look, I have a humble suggestion for many of my colleagues in the quote-unquote liberal media. How about in the year 2022, we stop playing down, minimizing, whitewashing people who literally say or do fascist things. People who want to overturn elections and ban Muslims. People who, as in the case of Italy's next prime minister, spout great replacement theory while running a political party that has a direct connection back to Benito Mussolini himself.
Broadly, Fratelli d'Italia is a party that centres its message on a very harsh nationalist identity politics, the defence of the natural family. At times in the past, that has, even in the recent past, that's involved things like great replacement theory, claiming that the left plans a ethnic substitution of whites in alliance with speculators like George Soros and this kind of thing. But in this campaign, it basically mixed some of that kind of identity politics with the message that actually on the economy and on foreign policy, it won't be too disruptive in terms of who votes for them. Basically, I think it's kind of too easy to sort of assume that, well, you know, they're this like rebellious force, so therefore they're like mobilizing, you know, disgruntled, left behind, working class voters, this kind of thing. But really, actually, if you look at the electorate and the overall right wing vote, you know, where the votes have come from, it's quite clear that basically what's happened is that Fratelli d'Italia, Brothers of Italy, now has basically won votes from its own allies. The overall right wing vote is basically the same as it was in the 1990s and 2000s. Mid 40s%. So in that sense, there's not really an expansion of the electorate. There are, of course, certain changes which have happened as Fratelli d'Italia has become a bigger party. I mean, in 2018, it only got 4%. So it was then had a very like identitarian electorate that probably previously belonged to other sort of neo-fascist parties, whereas this time it had a lot more things like holding a conference where it sort of showed off its business credentials, including a few other kind of former Berlusconi ministers and that kind of thing, in order to sort of project the image of a sort of broader right-wing party, but within which the sort of old neo-fascist tradition is still somehow part.
So that brings up something interesting, which is, in your articles, part of what you have argued is that this rise was, on one hand, kind of a long time in the making, and that the center right, supposedly more moderate, or supposedly, parties that were supposed to be like a moderating force, actually enabled and helped accelerate the rise of the far right. So how exactly has this played out over the last couple of years?
Well, as I said, there's this coalition of these three right-wing parties, and the first time they went to government together was already in 1994. Silvio Berlusconi, the billionaire tycoon, often compared to Trump and so on, he gave a speech in 2019 where he said, well, in the 1990s, I brought the fascists into government. He actually used the word fascists. I constitutionalized and legitimized them. I sort of brought them into the tent. But over time, while he had a dominant position in the right-wing coalition in the 90s and 2000s, that's kind of ebbed, particularly in the post-2008 crisis period, partly because Berlusconi has often gone into a sort of broad tent or technocratic governments, which has sort of undermined his hold on the right, and then turns sort of pushed voters towards the further right options. We saw Matteo Salvini's Lega, even before this, took over the leadership of the right wing from Berlusconi. But then also, I think there's a strange kind of reinvention of Berlusconi in recent years as a kind of cuddlier and more moderate figure, which is rather strange for anyone who remembers the 2000s. It bears obvious comparison with the way in which George W. Bush how his legacy has been sort of reinterpreted by parts of the US, sort of centrist and center-right, in the wake of Trump, in the sense that a figure who was previously seen as extreme and as pushing away from the imagined, more moderate traditions of his party, then in turn becomes the golden age who was longed for. But yeah, I mean, Berlusconi's government's played an important role in questioning the kind of anti-fascist identity of the Italian Republic, in focusing policy on harsh attacks on immigrants, and in appointing former fascists to ministerial roles.
You know Italian politics better than most. You know Meloni herself. Is this fascism? Is this a neo-fascist authoritarian party that's about to take power?
Absolutely. It's a neo-fascist who, she herself was an activist, a militant in a neo-fascist group when she was only 15. She never changed since then. She'd been elected a week ago, and she's already threatening to sue journalists, critics. I debated her on multiple occasions. She denied that fascism exists, but she never disavowed her fascist base. Her brother-in-law, Lollobrigida, who happened to be also a party member, her right hand, but also in charge of the reforms, built, financed mausoleums, crypts to fascist generals who committed war crimes, who committed atrocity. Her party celebrated fascist general who covered up massacres in Italy. People died in Italy because fascists bombed across the countries from the 70s on. They covered up and they celebrated that. She endorsed extremist policies. She thinks that the LGBT community, immigrants, minorities are a threat to traditional identity. She called herself Christian. That means anybody that is not Christian somehow is a threat, is an existential threat.
Following Meloni's election, you tweeted about a video that she shared back in August, which appeared to show a woman being attacked, raped even by an asylum seeker. Pretty gruesome stuff. You also pointed out that her father, who is estranged, she hasn't seen him since she was a child, was a convicted drug trafficker. I think you were making the point that people shouldn't be conflated with other people. Meloni responded to that in a post on Facebook, appearing to threaten a lawsuit against you. Have you been contacted by her lawyers? And do you see this as her trying to silence journalistic criticism?
Absolutely. This is typical fascist politics. She's been trying her people, the founder of her party, Crosetto, but also her brother-in-law, on multiple occasions threatened me with lawsuits, but also threatened other journalists who currently are living under police protection, Mehdi. The person who broke the stories about Meloni's family financing these crypts, these mausoleums, the fascist general, is Paolo Brizzi. He lives under police protection. He was threatened to be sued on multiple occasions. But in my case, because I'm Black, the only Muslim voice on Italian television, she singled me out.
Coincidence.
I'm not the person that broke the story about her father. I simply suggested that nobody should generalize. Her own father was a drug trafficker. She's not to blame, but she's blaming and demonizing, criminalizing all immigrants. She used me as an example to silence everybody else.
I should point out that she and her party publicly, officially disavow fascism, even though she is on record praising Italian fascists from the Mussolini period, and she has spouted a version of great replacement theory. Watch, great replacement theory is very popular in America thanks to Tucker Carlson and Fox. Let's talk about the warm embrace Meloni has received from conservatives here. What does that say about the GOP?
I mean, fascists flock together, right? The only difference between male fascists and Italy's Meloni is lipstick. She wears pastel colors. She wears sneakers. She wears lipstick. She smiles. She's a mother and she's a fascist. It's a concept called gender washing when you use women to soften the image of an authoritarian, but remove it, it's the same. There's a reason why Steve Bannon has allied with her for years, why he praised her. There's a reason why CPAC, the CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, invited her to speak in 2022. They also invited Viktor Orban of Hungary, who has praised her. Also, Ted Cruz praised her. Tucker Carlson had Carrie Lake, who's running for governor of Arizona, who praised her and said, she's saying exactly what I want to say, right? So this is a right-wing alliance. And I also want to remind people that as a 19-year-old youth activist, she praised Mussolini. She said he was a good politician. He did anything he did good, he did good for Italy, like aligning with the Nazis. And she's never disavowed it. At least Marine Le Pen disavowed her anti-Semitic father. Maloney has never disavowed in any way, shape, or form Mussolini. What do you think she is? Let's play taboo. Fascist.
So a lot of people watching this, Dean, will say, oh, liberals, leftists, they call everyone a fascist, even though we're talking about someone who specifically runs a party that's descended from the post-fascist party of 1946. I would say that some in our own industry, Dean, as I pointed out in my commentary before the break, they also want to play down the F word. There's a lot of like, let's calm down. She's not so bad. I feel like it's 2016 all over again, Dean.
Very much so. And I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe you talk to these people in the media every day. What is going on in their minds that they feel like they have to whitewash it or both sides? Yeah, Edward R. Murrow famously said, there are not two sides to every story. And I wish more in the media would take that to heart. The idea. And I remember writing an article a few weeks after the election saying that Donald Trump was plotting a coup. And I had a pushback by people going, you're outrageous. How dare you say that?
Yeah,
and then
same.
In more recent times, use terms fascist. Same. I think part of it, Mehdi, like you did in your tweet, we have to explain what that means because people think it's like we're doing a mirror of the right saying we're socialist. We have to explain what fascist is. It's an enemy of democracy. At its essence, understand that.
Yeah.
It's embracing violence. It's about pitting people against each other. It's destabilizing institutions. But it's the enemy of democracy. If nothing else you take away from me, enemy of democracy. That is fascism. That's what these people are about.
Well said. Well said, Dean. Rula, this idea that you are the enemy of democracy, you're the enemy of women's rights, you're the enemy of minority communities, both immigrants and gay and lesbian transgender communities, you see that in Italy. You see that here in the US. There are some commonalities, Rula. And then you see Iranian women protesting against their own authoritarian, anti-democratic government. And you wonder, how much credibility do some people in the West have to be standing with those Iranian women, given what's happening in our own countries? I look at authoritarianism globally and I wonder, we have to fight it everywhere, do we not?
Absolutely, Mehdi. But also, we have to understand this is a global movement. We go back to Meloni. Meloni, in 2018, said on video, I repeat, on video, that she actually supports the Hezbollah militias, she supports Assad, she supports Putin, because somehow they are defending Christianity in Syria. This is what she said. In that context, she also said that she endorsed torture because it's a good tool for law enforcement so they can defend themselves. This is what she says. So when they are whitewashing her in our national media, they're actually, she that's what she craves the most, legitimacy. That's what she wants. She wants to be normalized. The way that fascism creep globally and take over is by being normalized and by making it socially acceptable. And it is dangerous to minorities. This woman actually is the only party, the only leader of a party in Italy who's a woman who voted against women's rights, especially equal pay.
Talking about what happened in Italy this, you know, this past few days over the 100-year stretch, you see the patterns, you see what you call the rhymes of history. And in doing this book, American Psychosis, I saw the same thing in American history. We see patterns again and again that even we live through that we don't recognize. That, you know, the Republican Party, and, you know, we're now having a debate about whether MAGA extremism is something akin to fascism. But the Republican Party for 70 years keeps having this dance with extremism, you know, encouraging and exploiting extremism. It's happened all the time. What we see now with Donald Trump and the Republican Party is not an aberration. It's a continuation. And I was struck because I was, you know, reading up on the Italian election earlier today, and there was an academic in Europe who was talking about the history, and he said, what we're seeing in Italy is nothing new. I mean, you make that point quite obviously, but even in the last 50 years, the far right has always been there, starting at the end of World War to. And it has bubbled up and bubbled down, bubbled up and bubbled down. And now it's just emerging, but it's always been there. The same way that I think we've always had a fringe far-right fanaticism here that the Republican Party has always tried to exploit to its own benefit, whether it was McCarthyism, the Birchers, white segregationists in the 60s and 70s. And Donald Trump just made it burst out. And it's interesting. In Italy, you know, they have a multiple party system. So in Italy, the fringe elements, the far right, the fascistic elements get their own parties. In America, it doesn't work that way. We don't have multiple parties, but we have seen the expansion of the influence of these extremists within the Republican Party. The Republican Party acting like a coalition in Europe, taking them in to get power and juice to the extent that we even see Donald Trump in recent days welcoming the QAnon movement into his Trumpist Republican Party, the way that the majority or the close to majority coalition in Italy has taken in and has been led by the fascists.
David, I was struck by the fact that you document over and over again these moments where what we consider to be the mainstream Republican Party has to confront how much they want to be associated with people who they see and movements that they see as toxic, anti-democratic, extreme, and in most cases, embarrassing. You talk about that with the John Birch Society, for example, and elements of the Goldwater campaign and the conservative media around that time. You talk about it with Dwight Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, as President Eisenhower having to confront McCarthyism and the appeal of Joe McCarthy, both at home in Wisconsin, where he was an incredibly towering figure, but also in terms of the way he tapped into some real dangerous energy on the far right. And I feel like you've busted a bunch of myths in terms of these sort of self-serving histories where we've sort of told ourselves left, right, and center that the Republican Party, the mainstream Republican Party, has effectively policed those extremes and kept them at bay until now. And in fact, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but what I took from your book is that there are multiple instances in which the guys who we think of as the good guys, or at least the mainstream people, actually chose deliberately to keep cultivating those extremes, to keep those, you know, the QAnon movements of their time alive and agitating for the Republican cause.
You know, again, the pattern is obvious once you go back and look. There is not a single major Republican president or presidential candidate who did not embrace extremism to some degree. It waxes and wanes, and some do, and some have done it more intensely than others, but it's always in part of the Republican playbook. A recent example that, of course, you'll remember, and most of our viewers will, would be John Boehner embracing the Tea Party. The Tea Party was an extremist movement that, you know, was arguing that Barack Obama was a secret socialist Muslim born in Africa who had a secret plan to destroy the American economy so he could impose a totalitarian dictatorship. I mean, it's irrational the way McCarthyism was irrational and the way that QAnon is irrational. And John Boehner, country club Republican, he knew that, but he invited the Tea Party literally onto the steps of the Capitol for demonstrations, brought him into the party because they helped him get elected speaker. They then chased him out, but he validated and authenticated the Tea Party perspective. And like, you know, McCarthyism, the Birchers, or you go over to the fascist of Europe, there's a core there. And the element that I see uniting all this is that they look at the other side, their political enemies, and they demonize and dehumanize them. They're subversive. They want to destroy their society. The McCarthyites believe there was a cabal that wanted to turn the U.S. over to the Soviets and that was being run by people in the U.S. government. I just described the Tea Party conspiracy theory. We know what the QAnon conspiracy theory is. And if you listen to what Maloney is saying, she's saying, literally, the other day, I saw a speech of hers. She says, financial speculators, I don't know what that's code for, and woke activists want to steal our identity, our identities as Italians, Christians, and women and men, and turn us into consumer slaves. I mean, that's very QAnonish in a way. So, but it's all about challenge the other side, not on a matter of policy disputes or disagreeing on whether it's abortion or tax policy, but calling them subversives who want to destroy the country we love, take away our culture from us. And the Republicans have played that game again and again and again. And I'm sorry, you know, we can't both sides this. There is no equivalent on the Democratic side. This is an asymmetrical political history, and it's really, I mean, the book, you know, describes this, and I think it portrays the dark side of the GOP for 70 years that the party itself has not acknowledged, and that history and journalists have often not paid enough attention to as they should. But now we see it in, you know, in full view because Donald Trump has made it center stage.
Fernanda, you know, and I don't want to pigeonhole you because you are from Brazil, but we want to take advantage of your knowledge, and you've been following all this news out of Brazil, which on Sunday we saw the first round of their presidential election. And even though former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Lula of the leftist Workers' Party, received more votes than the far right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro, neither candidate won more than 50% of the vote. So that means there will be another runoff election at the end of the month. And Bolsonaro actually ended up doing better than polls had indicated. Fernanda, you tweeted about how this felt like the most consequential political weekend in Brazil since you left your homeland in 1998. Brazil is the fourth largest democracy in the world. And you can talk about how democratic it is, or it's, you know, that's a big question. It's a young democracy. So how have you been feeling about the election results, and how can you put them into context for all of us?
Well, there's so much to unpack there, but I, you know, when I woke up this morning, I thought, is there a map that shows, you know, kind of like the CNN maps that we see Wolf Blitzer, you know, showing this state went for this? Like, I wanted to know, you know, which states went for Lula and which states went for Bolsonaro. And then I wasn't surprised with what I found. Essentially, the northeastern part of Brazil, I come from the northeastern part of Brazil, the state of Bahia, and all these states in this region of Brazil are the poorest, neediest, and also blackest states in Brazil, the legacy of slavery and also the large influence of indigenous populations in this part is very present. The miscegenation of Brazil is very much what defines this region. And the entire region went for Lula. He won every single state in that region.
Wow.
But then if you look at southern Brazil, São Paulo and the states south of São Paulo, also Rio, those were states that are more centers of business and wealthier, much more influenced by Europe, especially the southern tip of Brazil, large German, Italian immigration. So they are a lot more white, as we understand white to be. And these states all went for Bolsonaro, in addition to large landowning states, states where lots of the landowners and a lot of the land is.
Yeah.
So it really, the result, what it shows is two Brazils. You know, this is a battle between the two countries that have always obviously coexisted, being a part of one thing, but they're actually fragments of one thing that's not a unity, which is a lot like what we have been talking about here in the United States since Trump got elected, although obviously it predates Trump, right?
Yeah, but this is the question I have. And Sabrina, you mentioned the future of democracy in the United States. But also when it comes to Brazil, like Bolsonaro's already, he's already starting to set the stage for what quote unquote rigged election. Sabrina, you want to jump in? Because it seems like, are we witnessing a Trump playbook in Brazil, or at least from what you've been following, Sabrina? Just jump in, and then Fernanda, give us your thoughts as well about this.
I mean, this is something that we're seeing, you know, right-wing candidates throughout the world, not exclusively right-wing candidates, but talking about, you know, voter fraud, you know, lack of trust in elections, you know, the erosion of democracy. Can we rely on the results that we're seeing? So it's not surprising if we hear more of that from Bolsonaro in the coming days and weeks, I would say. But I would trust the resident expert here, Fernanda, on all things Brazil.
I'm the same way, but I just want, you know, you're Latin Americanist like me, you know, you follow it.
What I can say is, though, it's obvious already from like seeing Twitter and seeing like Brazilian Americans in Miami, for example, that, you know,
voted for Bolsonaro starting to question, like, did Lula really win?
Exactly.
Like, or, you know, are already kind of prognosticating about the runoff, you know, and trying to see how
exactly
votes will be consolidated for Bolsonaro to ultimately win. So there's always speculation around it. And I think for months, we've kind of been gearing up those that pay attention to Latin America. We saw some of the conversations with the Colombian election.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing it with Brazil. So I can expect a lot more of the same in the coming days.
Yeah. Fernanda, I mean, that notion of this young democracy and you're going to have this incumbent who he's already suggesting that there's fraud. What does that mean in the context of Brazilian politics for you, like given the history of the country?
Well, I was born in 1973, and it was only 12 years later that the military dictatorship that had installed itself in 64 ended in Brazil. So we're talking about a really, really young democracy currently run by a president who has really taken a page out of Trump's playbook. Although I think Trump and his people also learned a lot from Bolsonaro in Brazil, and he's been using even some of the same language. There is an appropriation of the yellow and green colors of the Brazilian flag. They are now representative of him. The word patriot, patriotism, has been hijacked to mean support for him and his policies. You have this idea that he's this God-sent candidate who came to save Brazil from doomsday, when in reality, there are a lot of questions about policies he's had with indigenous populations, with the destruction of the Amazon, with the large number of former members of the military who are now in positions of power in ministries, running, you know, important agencies in Brazil without necessarily having come from that world and have the expertise required. So, you know, obviously for Brazil, it means a decision about the kind of country that it's going to be in the future, the type of relations that it's going to have to a country like the United States that's currently run by a Democratic president. But one of the most interesting things I remember, I think it was sometime in last month, there was a story from the BBC that quoted both Steve Bannon and Patrick Leahy. So people from completely opposite sides of the political spectrum, both saying how consequential this election would be, not just for Brazil, but for Latin America and for the world. And I do believe that the fact that they are both paying close attention to it means that we should, you know, as Americans, as people who care about democracy, we should be paying attention, because if it can happen in Brazil, and whatever it is that happens, it can happen anyplace else. I'm very worried. I'm just really very worried.
Well, Noam Chomsky, following up on that, the significance politically for Latin America and the world of a Lula victory, given the fact that we've seen now Latin America go from the early pink tide of the early 2000s, then there was a resurgence of right-wing governments and lawfare actions throughout the region, and now we're seeing almost every major country in Latin America voting in left-wing governments. So Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina, Peru, and Brazil, of course, is the largest country. This is a region with no nuclear weapons, with no major armed conflicts in the region right now. What would Lula coming to victory mean for the consolidation of this left-wing trend in Latin America?
Yes, you can add Chile to the list. Brazil is, of course, the largest, most important country in South and Latin America. And the direction in which Brazil goes is sure to have a major impact on these tendencies that you describe. Of course, they're bitterly opposed by the most of the business world, by the international investment community. What happens in Brazil could be certain to have a large-scale effect on whether this mildly left social democratic tendency will continue to develop and evolve. That's very important on the international scene as well. It'll, for example, affect the character of BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, now Indonesia, developing for independent, possibly independent force in global affairs. Now, during the early years of the century when Lula was in power, he managed to give the BRICS alignment a significant role in, in world affairs. In fact, Brazil became perhaps the most respected country internationally under Lula and his foreign minister, Celso Amorim. And if he returns to office, that could give an impetus to the further development of BRICS as a quite significant element in international affairs. That's connected with much broader tendencies, much broader issues about multipolarity and unipolarity in international affairs. The United States, of course, is working hard to maintain what's called a unilateral world order. Other elements in the world, other components of the world are not going along with that. Ukraine is a central part of that issue. About 90% of the countries of the world are not going along with the US-UK position on Ukraine, which is basically continue the war to weaken Russia and no negotiations. Even in Europe, like in Germany, that's not accepted. About over 3/4 of the German population wants to move to negotiations now. All of these things are taking place in the background, and what's happening in Brazil will have a significant impact on the direction in which they go. So there are many large issues at stake, also just domestically in Brazil. Brazil has extraordinary inequality, kind of like the United States in that respect. Enormous amount. It's potentially a very rich country. A century ago, it was called the Colossus of the South. It's never been realized, part because of the avarice of the wealthy sector, which has basically no commitment to the country. And that will move in one or the other direction, depending on the outcome of this election. So there is quite a lot at stake locally in Brazil, in Latin America altogether, as you mentioned, and even globally because of the role of the Latin American countries, Brazil in the lead, in setting the stage for the next phase of global order.
Turns out that Lula did lead Bolsonaro after the election this past weekend. He ended up with 48% of the vote. Unfortunately, Bolsonaro ended up with 43% of the vote. Nobody broke the 50% threshold, which means that we are now primed for a runoff election on October 30th, which is kind of a mess, Nick, for a variety of reasons. It means that a really, really volatile situation in Brazil is now going to escalate because we're heading into this runoff. It also means that Bolsonaro has more support than what a lot of us hoped that maybe he had or didn't have. He has also been prepped by such people as Steve Bannon and the people around Donald Trump in order to carry out anti-democratic actions. And there's still the specter of a coup. Nick, bad stuff all around.
Lots to unpack. You know, I'm surprised that you – we have the good friend of the breakdown, Mike Lindell, is involved in the Bannon thing as well. Was that on purpose that you wanted to leave him out and make him feel bad or just, you know?
Well, Mike Lindell is just sort of wandering from one room to another, squeezing his pillow and giving people money.
Yes.
I mean, he's sort of like a walking ATM to these people. So, of course, he –
Well, you know, I tried. It's funny, you know. The interestingly enough, the polls had indicated that it wouldn't be as close, even though 5% is kind of a, you know, a nice solid lead.
Yep.
For Lula. But like, you know, that gives rise to Bolsonaro to sort of accuse, like, the polls are always wrong. Everyone's lying about this. You see, I'm a victim here. And he's certainly been priming the country to either say that, like, only God is going to remove him or death. And I'm not willing to die. You know, I'm not going to die for this. So you have to be very concerned because it sounds a little familiar, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And real fast, let's go ahead and let's listen to a quick clip. Let's hear Steve Bannon. And for context, for those who don't know, this is at one of Mike Lindell's one of his cyber breakdown conferences a while back. You lose track. He does these things all the time. Basically, people go and get free food. He gives them a bunch of money. But it's Bannon sitting next to Mike Lindell. But who's hanging out with them? It's Jair Bolsonaro's son, who happens to also be a politician and a bit player in all of this. Let's give this a listen.
Well, you see, it's just not in the United States, right, Steve?
Well, next October, remember, 30 days, about 30 days before this monumental midterm election, he's going to face, his father, Jair Bolsonaro, is going to face the most dangerous leftist in the world, Lula, a criminal, a communist, and supported by all the media here in the United States, all the left-wing media. This election is the second most important election in the world, right? In the most important elections ever in South America. Bolsonaro will win unless it's stolen by, guess what? The machines.
The machines.
And again, here we are. This is the Trumpian playbook, which says very, very succinctly, if he loses, if Bolsonaro loses, then there's nothing else to believe besides the fact that this has been stolen by the machines. And I have to say, like, this is one of those weird mind-bending things, Nick. Bolsonaro outperformed all of the polls. All of the polls. Like, this is actually a victory by Bolsonaro. But they have to take that victory and spin it into a giant conspiracy. And they want both things at once, which is, look how much better I did than the polls. But also, I should have more support than this. It was stolen from me. It is mind-breakingly stupid.
Well, we have to now look at, like, the other, what was remaining of the percentage who now drop out of the race, and now it becomes a two-person race. I mean, what are your feelings about what the rest of those votes go towards, and if Lula is going to be able to just kind of hang on to this lead?
Well, so it looks like in a world that makes sense that Lula is going to walk away with this thing. It looks like he'll probably end up getting, if I had to put a number on it, and God knows that these numbers don't always mean anything anymore. If I had to put a number on it, I would say that Lula walks out. If everything stays the way it is, you put it in a vacuum sealed jar and just sort of move it on to October 30th. I'd say Lula ends up with 53-54%. But there's a couple things that are happening here. Bolsonaro is going to gain momentum from this, right? The fact that he outperformed this, he's sending it to a runoff. Second of all, the lead up to this election, there have been people murdered over the lead up to this election. People are getting shot. People are getting stabbed. There are fights in the streets. There are all kinds of these aggressive moments in which Bolsonaro's supporters are going after Worker Party, Lula's people, and hurting them. To go ahead and use that conspiracy theory that we're documenting here, basically, they are going to believe that they're going out to defend themselves. And that means possibly more violence. That means maybe intimidation at the polls. So right now, I mean, this thing, it's an etch-a-sketch that's going to get shook up. Mm-hmm. And the question also, and this is something, and here's a quick quiz for the Muckrake listeners out there. Why did Lula underperform? Yes, there are reasons why people like Bolsonaro, there's cultural stuff, there's appeals there. Nick, this communist leftist, right? Do you think that he campaigned as a leftist, or do you think he campaigned as a centrist, Nick?
Oh, I'll go with centrist for 300, Bob.
Yep, he most definitely did campaign as a centrist because he has sort of brought along a coalition of people. He, and tell me if this sounds familiar to American politics, he didn't have much of a plan for what's going to happen in the future. Maybe some light taxing of the wealthy, but that's about it. There's no real massive change, right? It's the same sort of conditions that we see here in America. So what's he going to do now? Do you go ahead and play conservatively, which we know oftentimes will go ahead and screw you in the long run? Or do you, like, let your flag fly and you talk about, like, plans and things to move the country forward? there's no telling what's going to happen at this point. But the one thing that's for sure is there's probably going to be some violence and some radicalization that spills out of this.
What's coming up next is one or more segments that were originally only for members, but since this is a reposted episode, I've unlocked them for everyone. Enjoy, and if you like getting the extra content, think about becoming a member yourself.
I guess the question for you is, what kinds of longer-term changes to Sweden's economy and, you know, the welfare state and trade union movements may have come before this moment that could have precipitated the rise or helped precipitate the rise of the Sweden Democrats?
When we look at this specific election, the shift between the left and the right was tiny, less than 0.5 percentage points. So we were already in a very tight situation
in
2018. As I said, the center party chose to ally with the left or chose to become a supporter of the left rather than entering into a negotiation with the populace. That party lost badly in the election, in this current election. The liberals lost badly in the current election, and the Christian Democrats lost badly in the current election. If you look at the sort of original three left parties, they lost badly in 2006. And in 2010, mm-hmm. And in 2014. Mm-hmm. But in this election, their combined vote share, Social Democrats, Left and Greens, actually increased. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, as you rightly say, what happened in this election has to do with kind of a recomposition of the center right or the right bloc, a recomposition of the right bloc, and now a kind of symbolic acceptance of the populists that had. So the story is really about the Swedish right in this particular election, I think. Mm-hmm. Going back to this picture we have of Sweden lots of people have, and I sometimes share it, and in any case, I profit from it since it gives me an opportunity to talk a lot. So when the Social Democrats were in power in between 1994-2006, they pursued a series of policies, which, you know, in the European context, we often refer to as the third way. And those policies involved reducing marginal income taxes on the rich. This was an agreement with the bourgeois parties. So a kind of reducing the progressive taxation, if you want to call it that, and capping overall taxation, putting lots of money into tertiary education, and trying to maintain public services and financing some of that by reducing unemployment insurance compensation, sick pay, and social assistance, and introducing, and you know, and this was all done in the name of increasing people's employability, social investment, investing in children instead of spending on consumption, spending on investment, and that this would generate a more equal society in the long run. If you look at the distribution of income among working age households, and I like to leave the elderly out. It's a kind of special category. But if you look at the Gini coefficient, which is only one of many measures, of course, of inequality. But if you look at disposable household income, working age households, the Gini coefficient, which is, it ranges between 0 and 1. And if you are at 1, then if the smaller the number is, the more equal the society is. I can talk about that if you want. But the Gini coefficient for disposable income increased by 37% from 1992 to 2018. So disposable income inequality has grown a lot. And what is striking is that in Sweden, this is somewhat different from a number of other countries, the Gini coefficient for market income, that is to say, people's earnings, household earnings before taxes and transfers, only increased by 13%. So more than half and nearly two thirds of the increase in inequality has happened through changes in the tax system and the income transfer system. So it's really the welfare state that has been in some ways reconfigured. And the Social Democrats were not the only people who did this. The non-left parties were in power in the early 90s and again from 2006 to 2014. But the Social Democrats did not reverse what those bourgeois governments had done. And in fact, in many ways, I think, initiated changes that contributed this kind of retreat from redistribution. And to go back to something you were hinting at when you were talking about populist voters in the U.S. and so on, I think a lot of Swedish working class voters kind of they observe inequality. Their households are struggling much more, especially after since 2008. Their households are struggling in a way they were not. They are convinced, with fairly good reason, that mainstream parties of the left and the right are not going to do anything. They haven't done anything for 20 years. Taxing the rich is not an option. And according to all of these parties, we have maxed out on overall taxation or overall public spending. Welfare chauvinism becomes a fairly rational way to try to deal with this problem from the point of view of quote unquote native Swedes. And also from the point of view of some immigrants who've been around for 20, 30 years or something like that. So now the pie to be redistributed isn't going to grow. And now we're looking for some criteria whereby I and my household and my community can improve their gain, get more from this pie. And, you know, saying that from the point of view of these people, saying that people who have yet to become citizens or people who have lived here for less than 10 years, you know, maybe that's a fair criterion for deciding who gets unemployment benefits and who doesn't, or who gets child care subsidies and who doesn't. So in that sense, I think many of us political scientists kind of attribute the problems of the left to these cultural issues, gay marriage, multiculturalism, all the woke things that the left is doing. And in my opinion, I don't want to say that isn't a problem in the eyes of working class voters, but I think the problem is very much about material grievances and the fact that the left isn't speaking to has kind of retreated from or taken we are responsible for managing the economy and this comes first kind of position.
It was almost exactly 100 years ago. It was 1922. It was October 1922. And the fascist party announced that they would march into the nation's capital. They would march on Rome. And the prime minister at the time knew that if they were going to march on Rome, this meant that the fascists were going to try to take over. They were going to try to mount a physical fascist coup. to defend against that, he wanted to call up the military to defend Rome, to stop the coup. But the king at the time wouldn't agree to that. So the military wasn't called up to defend the capital. And instead, what the king did is he caved to the fascists. He invited the leader of the fascists to form a government, to become the new prime minister. And the head of the fascists enthusiastically agreed. And the tens of thousands of his supporters who he had threatened would march on Rome to seize power in a coup. They didn't march on Rome to seize power. Instead, they marched on Rome in a victory parade because just the threat of them had made it so that he was handed power bloodlessly. That is how the fascists took power in Italy 100 years ago next month. They threatened to take power by force, didn't have to, because they intimidated everybody into giving them power ahead of their March on Rome. That's the famous March on Rome, October 1922. The centennial of that event will be next month. But when it happened in 1922, things in Italy changed pretty quickly. Within 3 years, by 1925, Italy was a one-party state. Within 3 years after that, by 1928, Mussolini had abolished elections altogether. It was a full-on fascist dictatorship. And, you know, not to spoil the plot or anything, but as you may know, things ended poorly for everyone. We think of the end of World War II, I think mostly here in the United States, we think of it as August 1945, right? The U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Japan in August. Japan surrendered just a few days later. But, of course, Japan was just one of the Axis powers. Things ended months earlier in Europe. April of that year, April 25th, 1945, is when Italy celebrates its Liberation Day, the day that Italy was liberated from both fascist rule and Nazi occupation. On that day, April 25th, 1945, the fascist leader who had been in power since 1922, Benito Mussolini, he tried to flee the country. He fled the country, or tried to flee the country, starting April 25th, 1945. Within 2 days, he was caught. He was disguised as a Nazi soldier wearing German army gear. He was caught on a rural road near Lake Como, just north of Milan. He tried to flee starting on the 25th. They caught him on the 27th. They held him overnight. And then early in the morning, on the side of a rural road on April 28th, they shot him dead. And then for something, I think, more than indignity, something more than just the end, they didn't just leave him there on the side of the road. They threw Mussolini's corpse into a truck and drove it back to Milan. Now, I have to warn you, if you're squeamish or if you've got kids watching with you, you may not want to see this. I'm only going to show this for a second, and I'm only going to show it once. So if you don't want to see it, I understand. But this is what they did with him in Milan. They hung his corpse upside down from the feet off of a metal girder. And they left it there, hanging in the square in Milan. It was him and his mistress and other top fascist officials who were executed alongside him. And believe it or not, it kind of got worse from there. The U.S. military ordered him, his body taken down. They ordered his body autopsied, cause of death, not hard to figure out at that point. They buried him in an unmarked grave, but it apparently wasn't unmarked enough. The following year, in 1946, a fascist supporter of Mussolini found him in that unmarked grave, dug him up, and stole his body. Whereupon the fascists started shuttling that corpse all over the place. They dragged this thing so all over the place that at least one report suggests that it lost one of its legs along the way. But they ended up hiding his body, such as it was, in a monastery for more than a decade until the mid-1950s. In 1957, they decided to dig him up again at that monastery, and they put him in his family's tomb in his hometown. And so now fascists the world over can have little fascist pilgrimages to the maybe final resting place of old peg-leg Mussolini. Like I said, it did not end well for anyone, let alone him. But, you know, supporters of that dictatorship, supporters of that variety of fascism, they don't only have the mausoleum to remember Mussolini by. Because the year after he was killed, right around the time that his body was getting dug up and shuttled around by his supporters. A year after the end of World War II, 1946, a man who had served as chief of staff in Mussolini's government founded a new political party to carry on the spirit of Mussolini, to carry on the Mussolini dream. By then, of course, you know, Italy had lost World War II. Mussolini had come to the end that he had come to. By then, it was overtly illegal to form a fascist party in Italy. It's understandable given what they had been through. Because an overt fascist party was illegal, when they founded this new party, sort of to keep alive the spirit of Mussolini, they couldn't use as the symbol of the new party the old symbol that he had used, that old cluster of rods that he used as the symbol of fascism from his day. So they instead picked a different symbol. They picked a flame colored red, green, and white, colored the colors of the Italian flag. It's supposed to represent the eternal flame that is maintained at the grave of Mussolini. The grave of Mussolini, which is now the pilgrimage site for fascists worldwide. So, again, Mussolini's dead, really dead, in April 1945. The guy who was a chief of staff in Mussolini's government, the next year, 1946, forms this new party to keep fascism, to keep the spirit of Mussolini alive. That guy, who had been the chief of staff in the Mussolini government, he ran that party for years. The next head of the party after him said publicly that Mussolini was the greatest statesman of the 20th century. The party chief after him declared about his party, quote, "We are all heirs of Il Duce. We are all heirs of Mussolini." Right? They weren't exactly hiding their light under a bushel. This is the party designed to keep the legacy of Mussolini alive. But that guy who said, "We are all the heirs of Il Duce, we are all the heirs of Mussolini," that was the last head of that party before now. The head of that party now, today, just claimed victory for her party, and she is about to become the next prime minister of Italy. Back in 1922, Mussolini's success with his March on Rome, the fascist coup he was able to pull off in Italy, at the time, that seemed so successful, it seems like it could be replicated elsewhere. It inspired a particular guy in Germany to try the same thing in Bavaria. He planned the basically same approach, a show of force, a relatively small, violent cadre trying to take over through pure intimidation. In Bavaria, what he tried was called the Beer Hall Putsch. It was just a year after the March on Rome. That was November 1923 that they tried that. But even though it worked in Rome, in Bavaria, it didn't work. The dude running that effort got arrested, was tried and convicted, was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but then was released after only serving about 9 months. During his 9 months in jail, he wrote a book that ended up doing very well for him. It was called Mein Kampf. After he got released, he then set about capitalizing on his newfound fame, and all the time he'd had to think about how he was going to seize power for good the next time, which he did. Incidentally, I should mention, historians are pretty sure, not totally sure, but pretty sure that Hitler was informed as to what happened to Mussolini right before he died. In that one fateful week in 1945, you've got Mussolini trying to flee the country on the 25th. You've got him shot on the 28th. You've got him strung up upside down in Milan on the 29th. And then it is the 30th, the very next day, when Hitler killed himself in his bunker. And maybe learning what happened to Mussolini is part of what led to his decision to do that. But even though both Germany and Italy were defeated in World War II, right? Both Germany and Italy surrendered. And the fascist leaders of both of those countries died within 48 hours of each other, coincidentally or not. Germany subsequently, famously, went through an aggressive, decades-long, painful process of denazification, right? Plumbing the depths of why their country went that direction. Committing to the concept and to the practical realities that they can never do anything like that again. That happened in Germany, but no other country in Europe, including Italy, went through a process like that. And so we are at this very capital H historical moment right now, where history keeps telling us that the last time such and such happened is during these very, very, very dark times from the last century. And it is, I know, uncomfortable to talk about this part of history. It is uncomfortable to talk about the Second World War and the fascism of that time. But the reason we have to talk about it now is not to make a comparison. This is not to make an allegory between then and today. It's actually this history on its own terms. Mussolini really was the fascist dictator of Italy. And this is the party founded by his supporters and his staffers after his death that, as of today, is now going to rule Italy again. And this is obviously rattling everyone this side of Steve Bannon and CPAC. They apparently think it's delightful. But everybody else is kind of, you know, back of the envelope tallying this up, right? I mean, you look at the leaders who are congratulating Giorgia Meloni on her big win in Italy today. We've got Viktor Orban in Hungary. The great hero of the American right in Fox News now, right? Viktor Orban runs Hungary, where the European Parliament says he has now effectively ended real democracy. We've also got the Law and Justice Party in Poland, which is following the same playbook to do the same thing that Orban has done in Hungary, this time in Poland. We've got Marine Le Pen, the fascist leader in France, who came very close to winning the French presidency against Emmanuel Macron earlier this year. We've got the new far-right party that won the second highest share of the vote in Sweden a few weeks ago. The party literally founded by neo-Nazis and skinheads that may now be part of the Swedish government. And of course, we've got the Kremlin with Putin running a fascist dictatorship that is not only treating its own people in unspeakable ways, but it's now bursting out of its borders, invading its neighbors, taking territory away from other countries, which is the first time that has happened in Europe since, I'm sorry to say, World War II. In Russia tomorrow, they're going to announce the so-called results of these sham Potemkin little votes that they are holding in parts of Ukraine. Ukraine has pushed Russia way back on the battlefield. So in areas that Russian troops can still operate, the Kremlin has now decided that they're going to declare democracy to be in effect, and they're going to hold a vote, a real good, real fair vote at the point of a gun, where they've already proclaimed that the result of the vote will be that Ukrainians want to be taken over by Russia. These sham referendums they're doing, they're going to announce the results tomorrow. They're patently ridiculous. There's no sense in which these are real or legitimate elections. But they will use these fake elections, these fake votes, to do two things. To justify moving the border, to justify taking these parts of this other country, taking these parts of Ukraine and declaring that these are now part of Russia instead. That's one of the things they're doing with this set of sham referenda, these fake votes they're taking in eastern Ukraine. But the other reason they're doing it is to make a mockery of democracy, right? To make it seem like elections are just fake. Oh, hey, you in the West, you say that voting is what makes things legitimate. Well, here's what we call a vote. What, are you going to criticize our democracy? We thought you loved voting. This is just what the people want. We're just following the desires of the people. You sort of tally, take a sort of, you know, back of the envelope tally in terms of how we're heading as a world in terms of authoritarian and indeed fascist forms of government versus small d democracy. One side's winning right now. In our country, we are 6 weeks out as of tomorrow from our first big national election since the party of the ousted right-wing president tried to maintain him in power by force, by a mass assault on the U.S. Capitol from his supporters. It was just 2 years ago this past week in the run-up to that 2020 election when Trump started saying outright that he would not accept the results of that election unless he won. That was a, you know, crazy benchmark for American politics at the time, but it's now the new normal, not just for him, but for political candidates of his party. Hundreds of Republican candidates for office are standing for office 6 weeks from now on the premise that the last election result from 2020 shouldn't have counted and maybe the next one shouldn't either. Let's see how it turns out. And I think we think of this as a sort of tactical radicalism on the part of Trump era Republicans. A threat to the, you know, the technical nuts and bolts, you know, first Tuesday in July system by which we pick winners by voting. But it's actually a much simpler problem than that, which I think you can see more easily when you see it happening in other countries. And it is. And when you can see what changes in other countries Republicans here are cheering for abroad. And yes, I think it is easier to see when you can see when it has happened before, what this is descended from in history. Because no longer respecting election results isn't just about messing with elections themselves. It's about a different kind of governance, a different kind of power. If they do not want your vote to determine who is in power. That means they don't want to have to use power to try to meet your needs. I'll say that one more time. If they do not want it to be your vote that determines who is in power, it means that they don't want to have to use power to try to meet your needs, to try to earn your vote. Yes, this is about messing with elections. Yes, this is about minority rule instead of majority rule. But fundamentally, basically, at its very simplest level, this is the big thing that history tells us about, right? This is the thing that is easier to see in other countries than in our own. But this is a very simple thing. It is about separating power from the preferences of the people. And instead, just ruling over the people by force, for their own purposes and to meet their own needs instead of the needs of the people. If you are trying to get and hold power by force and intimidation and not because the people want you there, that doesn't end well for anyone. Not just in history, not just as a political abstraction, but in terms of how we live and what the prospects are for our families, right? What are the prospects for you and for your future and for your kids and for their future? Whether or not you care about how it's gone in history. Whether or not you care about how it's gone in history when the antecedents to these folks got in power. Whether or not you care about majority rule or minority rule as concepts. Whether you care at all about the isms at the heart of all of these discussions. This is about your life. In a very practical, everyday sense, if there is a party that is trying to cast doubt on elections as the way we choose who's in power, it means they want to stay in power regardless of elections. They want to stay in power without your consent and without your ability to remove them, which means they do not want to serve you. And that means if you want government to do anything at all to make your family's life materially better, more stable, more dignified, this is a flashing red siren about the abandonment of that task. And it is sometimes easier to see that in faraway countries than it is here and close up. And it is sometimes easier to see it in history, so we can recognize how it both leads to and rhymes with what we are going through today.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. As always, keep the comments coming in. You can leave a voicemail or text at 202-999-3991 or email me to j@bestofleft.com. These episodes are remastered and produced by Dion Clark, Aaron Clayton, and myself. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes along with Amanda Hoffman as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support, through our Patreon page, or from right inside the Apple Podcasts app. And if you want to continue the discussion, join our Discord community. There's a link to join in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, with new episodes coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestofleft.com.